I can run to Iraq like this.
I can run to Iraq like this.
All the way to Baghdad like this.
All the way to Baghdad like this.
And when I get to Iraq, Saddam's gonna say.
And when I get to Iraq, Saddam's gonna say.
How'd you get to Iraq in just one day?
How'd you get to Iraq in just one day?
And I'll reply with a whole lot of anger.
And I'll reply with a whole lot of anger.
Blood and guts and a little bit of danger.
Blood and guts and a little bit of danger.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
That's for me.
That's for me.
Hey, T.
Hey, T.
Every day.
Every day.
Hey, T. Pity every day.
Pity, pity every day.
Build your body the Marine Corps way.
Build your body the Marine Corps way.
Luistert naar Radio Angelo.
Welkom bij deze podcast van Radio Angelo in het kader van het Theaterfestival 2010. Deze aflevering gaat volledig over de Irakese geesten, een voorstelling van Mokallad Rasem, die je van 27 tot 29 augustus kunt zien in Monti. Het is sowieso een aanrader hoe verschrikkelijk het onderwerp ook is. De oorlogen eigenlijk in Irak, zowel vroeger als nu, als allicht ook in de toekomst, en de impact die dat heeft op de generatie van deze theatermaker. Mokallad Rasem die werkt al 4 jaar in België. Hij is gevlucht voor de oorlog. Maar hij maakt hier geweldige voorstellingen in een Europese en Arabische context en al dat soort dingen door elkaar. Deze voorstelling heeft hij gemaakt met 2 andere gevluchte Irakese acteurs en met 2 Vlaams-Duitse actrices. Zeker gaan kijken. Nu, wat het precies allemaal is, waar u naar gaat kijken als u daarheen gaat, dat gaan we niet vertellen. Wat we wel gaan doen, is die oorlog een beetje breder kaderen. We hebben dankzij de vriendelijke collega's van de BBC een geweldige reeks documentaires aaneengeplakt. Daar kunt u naar luisteren, na een hoop protestsongs van hedendaagse Amerikaanse artiesten. En de mening van George Carlin, waarschijnlijk mijn favoriete levende filosoof, die even kort het probleem in de Persische Golf samenvat.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the war in the Persian Gulf. Big doings in the Persian Gulf. You know my favorite part of that war? It's the first war we ever had that was on every channel plus cable. And the war got good ratings too, didn't it? Got good ratings. Well, we like war. We like war. We're a warlike people. We like war because we're good at it. And you know why we're good at it? Because we get a lot of practice. This country's only 200 years old and already we've had 10 major wars. We average a major war every 20 years in this country, so we're good at it. And it's a good thing we are. We're not very good at anything else anymore. Huh? Can't build a decent car, can't make a TV set or a VCR worth the fuck. Got no steel industry left, can't educate our young people, can't get health care to our old people, but we can bomb the shit out of your country, all right. Huh? We can bomb the shit out of your country, all right. Especially if your country is full of brown people. Oh, we like that, don't we? That's our hobby. That's our new job in the world, bombing brown people. Iraq, Panama, Grenada, Libya, you got some brown people in your country. Tell them to watch the fuck out, or we'll goddamn bomb them. Well, when's the last white people you can remember that we bombed? Can you remember the last white? Can you remember any white people we've ever bombed? The Germans, those are the only ones, and that's only because they were trying to cut in on our action. They wanted to dominate the world. Bullshit, that's our fucking job. That's our fucking job. Now we only bomb brown people. Not because they're trying to cut in on our action, just because they're brown. And you probably noticed, I don't feel about that war the way we were told we were supposed to feel about that war, the way we were ordered and instructed by the United States government to feel about that war. You see, I tell you, my mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do, it's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I don't just roll over when I'm told to. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. Nothing. Zero. Nope. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country, who in the case of the Persian Gulf War were nothing more than unpaid employees of the Department of Defense, and who most of the time function as kind of an unofficial public relations agency for the United States government. So I don't listen to them, I don't really believe in my country, and I gotta tell you folks, I don't get all choked up about American flags. I consider them to be symbols, and I leave symbols to the symbol-minded. Me, I look at war a little bit differently. To me, war is a lot of prick-waving, okay? Simple thing, that's all it is. War is a whole lot of men standing out in a field waving their pricks at one another. Men are insecure about the size of their dicks, and so they have to kill one another over the idea. That's what all that asshole jock bullshit is all about. That's what all that adolescent macho male posturing and strutting in bars and locker rooms is all about. It's called dick fear. Men are terrified that their pricks are inadequate, and so they have to compete with one another to feel better about themselves. And since war is the ultimate competition, basically men are killing each other in order to improve their self-esteem. You don't have to be a historian or a political scientist to see the bigger dick foreign policy theory at work. It sounds like this. What? They have bigger dicks? Bomb them! And, of course, the bombs and the rockets and the bullets are all shaped like dicks. It's a subconscious need to project the penis into other people's affairs. It's called fucking with people! So, as far as I'm concerned, that whole thing in the Persian Gulf was nothing more than a big prick-waving dick fight. In this particular case, Saddam Hussein had questioned the size of George Bush's dick. And George Bush had been called a wimp for so long. Wimp rhymes with limp. George has been called a wimp for so long that he has to act out his manhood fantasies by sending other people's children to die. Even the name Bush. Even the name Bush is related to the genitals without being the genitals. A bush is a sort of passive secondary sex characteristic. Now, if this man's name had been George Boner, well, he might have felt a little bit better about himself and we wouldn't have had any trouble over there in the first place. This whole country has a manhood problem. Big manhood problem in the USA. You can tell from the language we use. Language always gives you away. What did we do wrong in Vietnam? We pulled out. Huh? Not a very manly thing to do, is it? When you're fucking people, you gotta stay in there and fuck them good. Fuck them all the way. Fuck them till the end. Fuck them to death. Fuck them to death. Fuck them to death. Stay in there and keep fucking them until they're all dead. We left a few women and children alive in Vietnam, and we haven't felt good about ourselves since. That's why in the Persian Gulf, George Bush had to say, "This will not be another Vietnam." He actually used these words. He said, "This time we're going all the way." Imagine an American president using the sexual slang of a 13-year-old to describe his foreign policy. If you want to know what happened in the Persian Gulf, just remember the names of the two men who were running that war. Dick Cheney and Colin Powell. Somebody got fucked in the ass.
Radio.
Angelo.
1, 2, 3. Yeah, it's from national underground, thunderbounds when I stop the ground. Like a million elephants, a silverback, orangutan. You can't stop a train. Who wants up, don't come unprepared. I'll leave there, but when I leave there, better be a household name. Weatherman telling us it ain't gonna rain. So now we sitting in a drop top soaking wet. In a silk suit, try not to sweat. Hit somersaults without the net. But this be the year that we won't forget. 1999. Too hot to jump in jail. Too low to dig, I might just touch hell. Hot, get a life body on sale. Then I might catch you a spell. Look at what came in the mail. I'm scared like some arm and hammer. So go grilling a baby mama. Black hair lacked in the back of pebbles. Stack of questions with no answers. Cure for cancer, cure for AIDS. Make a nigga wanna stay on tour for days. Get back home, things are wrong. When not really it was bad, I
them ass up to a ball of power. Thoughts at 1,000 miles per hour. Hello, ghetto, let your brain breathe. Believe there's always more. Still stay free. Big things happen every time we meet. Like a track team, crack team, dying to geek. Outcasts bumping up and down the street. Slam back, Cadillac, 5-5, nigga, dig 75 MCs. Freestyle to the beat, cause we get crossed, stay drunk at the club. Should've bought an ounce, but you caught the dub. Should've held back, but you told the punch. Supposed to meet you good, but you packed the lunch. No D to the U to the G for you. Got a son on the way by the name of Bamboo. Got a little baby girl, 4 year Jordan. Never turn my back on my kids for them. Should've hit it, quit it, rag, top. Before you re-up, get a ladder, top. Make a bending for yourself, boy, set some goals. Make a fat dime out of dusty coal. Record number 4, but we on the road. Hold up, slow up, stop, control like Janet. Planet, stay on the Azonia. Moving like floor, come straight to Florida. Lock all your windows, then block the quarters. Put it up on bail, cause the women's in order. Like a 3-piece bitch, before I cut your daughter. Your kettle talk on bail, then I hit the border. Pity pat rapper trying to get the vibe. On my microphone beam, trying to stay alive. When you come to ATL, boy, you bet not high. Cause the Dundee family gon' ride.
Radio. Outcast en Bombs Over Baghdad en daarvoor George Carlin en zijn beknopte visie op de golfoorlogen in Irak. Zo dadelijk kunt u luisteren naar 5 korte, aaneengemonteerde documentaires van de BBC waarin ze het probleem in Irak naast dat van Vietnam leggen. En het is schrikwekkend hoeveel gelijkenissen er zijn, zowel politiek als humanitair. Zet u dus rustig in uw zetel en geniet van deze trouwens Engelstalige documentaire.
U luistert naar Radio Angelo.
The Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. for many on this crisp autumn day, still a place of pilgrimage and remembrance.
I was a corpsman, attached to 1st Marines, 67 to 68, and I was there during the Tet Offensive. It's very moving, it's emotional, and because I've seen it firsthand, you see things right up front. You know, you see emotion, you see trauma, you face death right then and there, and it does change you.
The memorial is a simple black granite wall set into a grassy bank, which carries the names of over 58,000 Americans killed or missing in the conflict.
I respect the military men who gave their lives. They're the real heroes. We're the survivors. We put our time there. Some like to say we put our time in hell, but as far as I'm concerned, it's here to respect those fallen heroes.
The war in Southeast Asia ended over 30 years ago, but it still casts a long shadow over America's current conflict in Iraq. Inevitably, comparisons are being made between the two wars. Not everyone, of course, welcomes such parallels. This was how President George Bush responded in April of 2004 to a question comparing the administration's growing problems in Iraq to the catastrophe that befell the Americans in Vietnam.
I think the analogy is false. I also happen to think that analogy sends the wrong message to our troops and sends the wrong message to the enemy.
But in a speech in August of this year, he shifted his ground, insisting that in Iraq, the United States could not afford to repeat the errors it had made in Southeast Asia.
One unmistakable legacy of Vietnam is that the price of America's withdrawal was paid by millions of innocent citizens whose agonies would add to our vocabulary new terms like boat people, re-education camps, and killing fields.
The response to the president's speech was swift and damning.
I thought that this is an abuse of history. Mr. Bush avoided using Vietnam as an analogy for a very long time because he did not want to invoke memories of a failed war.
Frankly, when I heard the president make the comparison between Vietnam and Iraq, I was appalled, as I have been many times in the past, at this president's really appalling lack of historical knowledge.
The views there of one of America's preeminent historians, Robert Dallek, and Lawrence Wilkerson, who was chief of staff to Mr. Bush's first Secretary of State, Colin Powell. In this BBC programme, Seeing Iraq, Thinking Vietnam, I'll be exploring the impact of these two conflicts on America's political psyche, and I'll be asking what all this means for the coming elections. But first, why did Mr. Bush change his mind in his August speech?
Thank you, and God bless.
Historian Robert Dallek says that President Bush made the analogy between Vietnam and Iraq largely for political purposes.
Now he saw an opportunity to use Vietnam against his war opponents, saying that if we leave Iraq, it will be like Vietnam, where there was a communist regime taking over, mayhem in Cambodia. But it's such a distortion. The mayhem in Cambodia was the product of our invasion, our so-called incursion, and the consequences of Vietnam was a failed war. And Bush had no answer to the question, would you have stayed in Vietnam for 10 more years? Would you have increased the number of troops to 1 million? There was no answer to that from him. So it's a false analogy that he's using for political purposes or to make a political argument.
The linkage between Iraq and Vietnam is almost inevitable, according to Leslie Gelb, today President Emeritus of the prestigious think tank, the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. But in the late 1960s, a senior official in the Pentagon.
Iraq is not Vietnam, but history is intent on harnessing them together, or politicians are intent on harnessing them together. And the reason is, in all public policy, we really argue by analogy. We can't prove things, so we use history to make our case. And Vietnam is the most significant historical comparison to what we're going through now, so it was inevitable that this would be the touchstone.
Leslie Gelb says that he thinks the president was right to bring this issue out into the open, but he disputes the president's historical reasoning.
People were talking about the comparison in private all the time. He made it public, but he did it the wrong way. He talked about Vietnam as if the reason we lost in Vietnam was a lack of public will back here at home, implying that that would be the same problem with the Iraq War. We could win it in the field, but we would lose it back here. And that, to me, was not the moral of Vietnam, and it is not the moral of Iraq. We lost the Vietnam War principally because we didn't understand Vietnam. We did well militarily, but you can't win insurgencies on the battlefield. You have to win political victories. It's, in essence, the same problem in Iraq.
Hell no, we won't go! Hell no, we won't go!
There's no question that the war was a central element in the turmoil that made up the 1960s.
Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute has been watching American politics for over four decades. Looking back, he says that a pivotal moment for the anti-Vietnam War movement came in the election year of 1968.
The immediate visceral reaction that people will have if you mention 1968 is Chicago. The Democratic Convention, the turmoil in the park, Mayor Daley screaming obscenities from the podium, journalists being punched and taken outside the arena, kids in the streets shouting epithets at the pigs, the police.
Those turbulent days in Chicago had a profound impact on American politics. David Gergen has worked as an advisor to four presidents and is now a professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard.
Vietnam has cast an extraordinarily long shadow over American politics, starting right out of the 60s when it splintered the Democratic Party and the consensus in the Democratic Party about international commitment. The party went to the left, and it paid a huge price in the polls. Those losses for the Democrats, the sense of weakness in the Democratic Party, helped to elect Richard Nixon, helped to elect Ronald Reagan, helped to elect George H.W. Bush, and indeed George W. Bush.
The Vietnam experience compromised the Democratic Party's foreign policy credentials. So could the war in Iraq have as profound an impact on the Republicans? David Gergen believes not. For all the unpopularity of Mr. Bush's war in Iraq, he says that the Republicans are likely to remain confident even if they lose the White House in 2008.
They're convinced that the Democratic policies, if Democrats take over the White House and have larger majorities in the Senate and the House, that they will blow it. And their policies of weakness or accommodation are going to allow things to get even worse on the international scene. I mean, the Republican argument basically is this. Hey, look, this has not been terrific with George W. Bush, but if you elect the Democrats, it's going to get one heck of a lot worse. If that prophecy is borne out, they think they'll be on a comeback trail.
Of course, the turmoil of the 1960s was not just about the war. It reflected much greater changes in American life, the struggle for civil rights, equality for women, and the creation of a more open, liberal society. But it was the war in Vietnam that brought this all sharply into focus. Demonstrations erupted at a number of American universities. I went to one campus marked by violence in the 1960s to compare the mood then and now.
Up until this time, while there'd been some events like this in the United States, they had been limited to civil rights demonstrations in the South. This is the first time that not only are these kinds of beatings taking place, but it's taking place on such an immense scale, as well as the tear gassing of what was ultimately somewhere in the vicinity of 5,000 to 10,000 students.
It was a shock, I think, to the people who were in the demonstration. It was a big shock to people who witnessed suddenly this explosion of broken glass and screaming and then people being ejected physically. And then the campus was in turmoil for quite some time.
Paul Soglin and Jim Rowan were both students here at the University of Wisconsin in Madison during those turbulent times. In the room where the student protests against the Vietnam War were planned, they told me how things came to a head.
There's a considerable concern about the relationship between the university and major U.S. corporations that were supporting the war in Vietnam. When it came time to singling out the most obvious, Dow, the maker of a lot of household cleansing products and soaps, seemed to be the most horrific in that it manufactured napalm, which we as a country were now using in Vietnam to defoliate entire areas of the country to inadvertently or deliberately attack civilian populations.
Dow must go! Dow must go!
Dow produces napalm, and 75% of all of Dow's production is for the military.
Dow must go!
Dow had a certain symbolic value and presence, but also students wanted to take a direct action. Dow was on the schedule for recruiting potential employees at the business school, and one thing led to another, and the demonstration got scheduled.
Reports will indicate that a squad of 50 Madison policemen were called to the scene and were met by an angry, vicious mob of 300 or more protesters.
When you reflect upon all of this, there's one inescapable conclusion. The campus is significantly different today than it was 40 years ago. The tens of thousands of students today don't have the risks of the draft. They don't have the level of political involvement.
Not just Madison. All campuses are relatively quiet compared to the Vietnam era. Students and faculty are materially more comfortable. They are less willing to put their careers at risk. I think there's a much higher level of fear in American society. It's less likely that people will, even if they're upset about the war in Iraq, take the next step, go out on the street, take an action, even write a letter to the editor. I think we're just a nation of sheep right now, and I think the campus reflects that.
I'm going to pass this now to Aniello Aliotto, who is working with a large community movement in Louisville, Kentucky. Are you on, Aniello?
I am. As everybody pretty much knows,
a conference call at the Washington-based headquarters of Americans Against Escalation in Iraq, a coalition of campaigners opposing President Bush's war. The battle for public opinion has moved from the street demonstrations and campus protests of the Vietnam era to cyberspace. A poster on the wall reads, "Ending the Iraq War, one email at a time." Kate Snyder is the organization's national field director.
This campaign and this movement is very much about using technology. You know, we have our YouTube channel. We do video clips in the field. We have an email list. We have a website. We have text message campaign for when we have actions, when we find our targets. We send out a message that shows up on, you know, your phone at work or wherever you may be, and you may show up to that site. We have a lot more tools at our disposal to use in this campaign.
It's not just technology that's different. Above all, the whole political and social climate has changed. This is reflected in the way the American public has divided in its attitude to the Iraq War. Pollster Andrew Kohut is president of the Pew Research Center.
The most important difference between opinion about the two conflicts is that when the American public soured on the war in Vietnam, it was a bipartisan sentiment, Republicans, Democrats, and independents. Of course, in the war in Iraq, there's a huge partisan gap in the way Republicans and Democrats see things, with independents coming closer to the Democratic view. If I can give you just one figure, in our most recent poll, 67% of Republicans said we're making progress in defeating the insurgents. That number was only 16% among Democrats.
I'm sitting at a table in the Red Arrow Diner in Manchester, New Hampshire. This restaurant's a popular stop on the campaign trail. New Hampshire may be small, but it matters. It traditionally holds the first of the presidential primary contests, where each party selects its candidate for the presidency.
My name is Elaine Boulay. I've been working here for the past 8 years, so I've seen a lot of political campaigning going on. I've always been a Republican. I've been a Republican, you know, for the past, I'd say, 10 years anyway. You know, I really don't feel like there's anybody in the Republican Party that I'm interested in. With us going into the war and what have you, I just feel as though the Democrats are where I'm leaning towards right now.
What are you looking for in your favorite Democratic candidate?
I think that I would be looking for somebody who has some experience. You know, I'm kind of leaning towards Hillary, but Barack Obama is certainly another choice that I may. You know, it's too soon right now, and I'm listening, but Hillary and Barack Obama are probably the two who are my top choices.
Alain Boulay, whose brother-in-law was killed in Iraq, is typical of a group of voters who could be crucial in this coming presidential election. Analyst Jennifer Donahue calls them military mums, women with traditional Republican leanings who have loved ones who served or who are still serving in the armed forces.
I think initially when the U.S. went into Iraq, these military moms were supportive of the invasion. They were, at that point, Republicans. I think what's happened since then, with so many tours of duty and so much public concern in the U.S. over the war, is that the support has eroded to the point where a lot of these people aren't sure who they're going to vote for. They're dissatisfied with President Bush. They're largely dissatisfied with Republican candidates who support Bush's policies and would carry them forward if elected. So they may be people who would trend towards, for example, Senator Clinton, who has said she'd like to take efforts to stop the war. So I think these voters are looking for, A, an end to the war, and B, a candidate who understands foreign policy well enough to actually find an exit strategy.
Okay, thank you.
Senator John McCain has served his country in battle, in the halls of Congress, and through his tireless efforts...
U.S. politics grassroots style. Republican presidential hopeful John McCain attends a town hall meeting in rural New Hampshire. I've come here to see how the Iraq war is playing in the campaign. McCain, who has backed the president's strategy in Iraq, acknowledged how unpopular the war had become.
I understand that the state of New Hampshire has made great sacrifice in this war. And the people of New Hampshire are saddened, and they're frustrated, and they're tired. And they want out. And I want out, too. But I want us out honorably, and I want us out in a way that we don't have to go back later on. Thank you.
A couple of questions for BBC Radio. How far is this election being played out in the shadow of Iraq?
The struggle against radical Islamic extremism is probably the overriding issue of this campaign.
How far do you feel that it is easy to articulate a position that's appealing to voters given the weariness with the war in Iraq?
I think it's very difficult.
Does that make your stand unpopular?
Oh, yeah, sure. You got to do what you believe is right. I'm wearing a bracelet of a woman whose son died in Iraq last year. I can't worry about my political ambitions when so much is at stake and so much sacrifice has already been made. I am convinced that if we set a date for withdrawal, as the Democrats want, then our young people will be back with greater sacrifice, greater challenges. Look, the greatest misunderstanding about this debate is that it doesn't matter how many troops are there, it depends on whether we are succeeding or failing. The point is, are we going to be succeeding and the Iraqis doing the job that we are now doing and us able to secure it and a functioning government, then Americans, I think, will at least have the patience.
The Iraq war is a difficult issue for the Republicans. The electoral arithmetic is against them. And as veteran political analyst David Gergen explains, the war looks set to remain the decisive factor in the coming electoral battle.
A year from the elections, it still appears that Iraq's going to be the single most important issue in the campaign, in the sense that it may have lost some of its drama. But there are so many people who are angry, who do not want to leave power in the hands of the Republicans, and many, many of them are independents. I cannot stress heavily enough how important that is. If you've got a country that's essentially 40% Democratic, 40% Republican, and they will both vote heavily along party lines, that 20%, or some say it's a smaller percentage now, if they shift predominantly toward the Democrats, they're going to go there because of the war, and that'll swing the election.
Iraq then overshadows this campaign, just as the Vietnam War overshadows so much of contemporary American politics. The Vietnam era tarnished the Democratic Party, paving the way for profound political change. Iraq may well have a more limited political impact, but inevitably, as former Pentagon official Leslie Gelb explains, the current war has served to rekindle many of the old struggles of the past.
Countries never get over wars, whether they are won or lost. If you win them, you have heroes. If you lose them, you always have villains and the fight over who the real villain was. And in the case of Vietnam, that battle has never ended between the hawks and the doves. And for the most part, it has carried over to Iraq with roughly the same people on roughly the same sides as before. And it makes the Iraq one all the more bitter.
Vietnam looks to have had a more fundamental impact on American politics than the current conflict in Iraq. But as foreign policy expert Kurt Campbell of the Center for a New American Security explains, the most important consequences of the Bush administration's entanglement in Iraq will be seen not at home, but abroad.
Vietnam is like a dark shadow over our politics. However, the United States recovered regionally and internationally relatively rapidly after our retreat in 1975. I think Iraq, it's going to be precisely the opposite. The consequences domestically, politically, seem grave now, but I think we'll recover relatively rapidly from those. It's going to be in the region that I think, and internationally, where the consequences of Iraq are likely to be much darker and much more troublesome for this and the next generation of American politicians and diplomats.